This podcast of The Business is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM, webcast at kcrw.com, and distributed by NPR.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with available real-time traffic monitoring. More information at acura.com.
Join KCRW online today and we'll send you a free gift. Choose the exclusive KCRW iTunes playlist featuring music from the KCRW airwaves or a one-year subscription to Newsweek magazine. You'll also be entered into the Mini Cooper Custom Sweepstakes and today's Daily Sweepstakes. Help support KCRW online. Go to kcrw.com and click on Join.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, we'll talk to the head of the Motion Picture Association of America about what he hopes to accomplish with the cavalcade of producers, directors, and moguls he's unleashing on the nation's capital this week. And we'll ask a seasoned Washington lobbyist what he thinks of their efforts. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Don't go anywhere. It's The Business from NPR. Triple treats and triple tricks on Wall Street this week, which reveal much about where entertainment is headed. Comcast Corporation, the biggest cable TV company in the land, announced that fourth quarter profits nearly tripled, the result of the triple play of discounted TV, internet, and phone packages. Even so, the latest earnings fell a little short of analysts' forecasts, and Comcast shares fell slightly on the news that it would have to keep on building that magical pipeline. The company says it'll drop $5 billion in capital expenditures this year. Similarly, Google's profits nearly tripled in the fourth quarter, and its revenue grew 67%. Naturally, the stock dropped 1.3%. Why? Well, amazing as Google is, they pay big commissions to advertising partners like MySpace and thousands of other websites. Of the $1.2 billion it made last year, Google paid over 80% of that in commissions back to its advertising partners. Soon, Google is going to be paying out even more. In Davos, Switzerland's annual meeting of the Billionaire Boys Club, YouTube co-CEO Chad Hurley said that his Google-owned video site is working on a plan to pay people for their videos. The lesson here? Even peak performers are still making it up as they go along. Elsewhere, pay cable outfit Showtime announced it was canceling a third season of the domestic terrorism drama Sleeper Cell, the show about everyday Americans who moonlight as radical Islamist terrorists. Less than 48 hours later, Sleeper Cell executive producers Cy Voris and Ethan Reif had set up a movie about that proto-Maoist terrorist, Robin Hood. This time, they're not behind the insurgency, no matter how well-intentioned. They plan to tell the story from the Sheriff of Nottingham's point of view. Russell Crowe will play the part of a noble lawman just trying to keep order in the peace-loving, gated community of Sherwood Forest. Like Robin Hood, Voris, Reif, and Crowe are no doubt very merry men. The writer's script sold for low seven figures, and Crowe will be paid $20 million against 20% of the gross. In other words, the very rich stealing from the obscenely rich. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up, Mr. Hollywood goes to Washington.
If he even starts to convince those senators, you might as well blow your brains out. You know that, don't you?
But next, what if you don't get nominated for an Oscar? The DVD rental company Netflix picked up the indie drama Sherry Baby for distribution at last year's Sundance Film Festival. Recognizing Maggie Gyllenhaal's exceptional performance, they brought in the folks from IFC Films to help market the film and go for Oscar gold. They got their hopes up when she was nominated for a Golden Globe. Those hopes were dashed when she was overlooked for the Academy Award, but two IFC-backed films did get Oscar nods, including Denmark's foreign language entry, After the Wedding.
Yoko. Välkommen, jag heter Jörgen. Alltså, jag behöver inte se mer. Oerhört fint. Jag behöver fortfarande lite tid att tänka igenom. Följ med måndag. Men du har ingenting annat, va?
Well, it's in Danish, but you got to trust me. Very powerful. Very, very, very powerful. Jonathan Searing is president of IFC Films. Jonathan Searing, welcome to the business.
Thanks for having me.
Describe the roller coaster of emotions that you rode on that Oscar nomination morn. A lot of things happening, good and not so good.
Well, you're absolutely right. It was for us that we were, you know, not to have Maggie Gyllenhaal nominated for Best Actress. We were crushed. We knew it was a long shot, but Maggie, you know, we thought was a very good long shot. That, you know, she just gave a performance that stood out.
You're referring to Sherry Baby.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so we were very disappointed. And but this was, we were huddled around a set in Park City, and we were at the Sundance Film Festival. So when the Best Foreign Language nominations came up, you know, we were hoping for one, but to get two for both After the Wedding and Days of Glory, we, you know, went from the depths of despair to the heights of euphoria.
Now, before we get to the good news about those foreign film nominations, let's talk a little bit about what happens now with Sherry Baby. What happens?
You know, Netflix plan for it was always to roll it out on video right around this time. So, you know, the film will not be expanding theatrically, but it will be released via Netflix on DVD. You know, I think any day now.
And if it had been nominated, might it have done things differently? Or would the fact that it was financed by a rental company, does that supersede any normal strategy?
Well, the distribution was financed by the rental company. And, I, you know, their plan was, you know, had it obviously gotten a nomination, we would have expanded theatrically. Mm-hmm. So they would have held off on the DVD release.
Mm-hmm. Were you relieved on some business level that you didn't have to sort of commit, you know, lots and lots of money to a campaign that would have been an uphill battle?
It wouldn't have been our money. That's always a question any distributor faces, is are you chasing an Oscar for a small, you know, relatively small movie with, and you're not going to get that money back.
So now to the good news. Two films you're releasing were nominated, the Danish film After the Wedding and the Algerian entry for the Oscars, which is Days of Glory.
Right.
What does the nomination in business terms really mean to you?
Days of Glory, we're re-releasing it. We had done a qualifying release with the Weinstein Company in November to qualify for all categories. But the re-release and going broader is going to be in middle of February. Mm-hmm. In terms of After the Wedding, our strategy for the film has always been to wait for us after the Oscars. It's a movie that, you know, we feel will perform extremely well. The fact that it got a nomination was something that we hoped for, but honestly, we didn't expect it.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't say we expected it for either film, but...
Did you campaign for it? I mean, was there a strategy in place?
We absolutely, yeah, mounted a campaign, but nothing, you know, nothing to the extent of, you know, the money that was spent on the Volver campaign or the money that was spent on Pan's Labyrinth. Or,
like,
know,
like, what are we talking about here? What kind of dough?
That we, you
yeah.
know, maybe 100,000.
Wow, okay.
Maybe. You know, those campaigns, both of those were in the millions.
So if you win, how big a deal is that?
It's a big deal, you know, for
I mean, prestige, I understand. But, I mean, in terms of the business model that you're in here, does a win really matter?
A win matters theatrically for either of these films. Whatever film wins a Best Foreign Language Film, you always, you know, it's guaranteed almost to be $1 million at the box office, an additional $1 million or $500,000, you know, depending on the film and the appeal of the film. Both of these movies are very commercial films, and you know, our strategy with both of them has always been they're going to play well regardless of an Oscar nomination, but the Oscar nomination will boost the box office for either one, and a win will, you know, will increase it even that much more.
Well, we wish you luck. Are you going to be in that maximum security prison that is the Kodak Theater?
I believe so. Sweaty palms and all.
Well, we'll be looking for you, please give us a report afterwards or even during. You know, we accept collect calls here at the business.
They confiscate cell phones with cameras in them, but I'll see what I can do.
All right. Jonathan Searing, head of IFC Films. John, thanks for being on the business.
No, thanks for having me.
This Tuesday, Hollywood will descend on Washington for a symposium they've called The Business of Show Business. Sounds familiar. Studio heads like Paramount's Brad Gray and media bigwigs like News Corporation President Peter Chernin will be on hand to break the fast with lawmakers. High-powered producers and directors, including Taylor Hackford, director of Ray, Steven Soderbergh, who needs no introduction, and Lily Zanuck, will hold informational seminars like The Art and Economics of Show Business and Intellectual Property. Many hands will be shaken and many shrimp peeled in the hopes of educating lawmakers about the importance of movies to the U.S. economy and, in the long run, creating legislation favorable to the industry. Former Illinois Congressman Dan Glickman now heads the Motion Picture Association of America, which is sponsoring the Schmooze Fest. Dan Glickman, welcome to the business.
Thank you very much.
Why the charm offensive with Washington now?
Well, it's a new Congress, and periodically we do our best to try to educate people about the understanding that the American motion picture industry is a thriving economic engine that creates hundreds of thousands of good-paying jobs, is of great economic benefit to communities around America, and it's an opportunity for us to tell this story in a thoughtful and fact-driven way so that the policymakers in Washington and perhaps worldwide will understand how significant and important this industry is.
Now, speaking of significant and important, how significant and important is it that it is now a Democratic Congress? Is it easier to advance the agenda of Hollywood when it is?
Most of the issues that the entertainment industry, particularly the film industry, face are bipartisan or nonpartisan issues. They may be trade, they may be tax, or, of course, we have a lot of at stake on strong intellectual property protection and enforcement. So our issues are really not partisan at all. I mean, the truth of the matter is that not only American people, but people around the world love our movies and our product. And it's interesting. This is the only industry in America that has a positive balance of payments surplus with every single country in the world, with the exception of China on occasion. But no other industry has that. And part of that is because people, consumers at home and around the world, love our movies. They reach them. They make them cry. They motivate them. They make them happy. And so, yeah, you know, I'm not telling you that every film that comes out is one that I would necessarily recommend to all my friends, but by and large, the product that we put out is very well accepted at home and around the world. And that's the reason why we're so successful. And our job with this conference is to let folks know why we're successful, what it takes to produce a film, how much is involved in terms of production, what the risk is, and then what the benefit is to the country in terms of jobs and economics.
It's interesting to me that you're doing it in a museum as opposed to some fancy hotel. Why are you doing it there?
The venue for it, which is it's a Museum of American Art and Portraiture, is a fitting location because the museum celebrates the extraordinary creativity of our country's artists, and so we're in the art business. In addition to that, it's kind of interesting. The museum is a National Historic Landmark, and was not only host to President Lincoln's inaugural ball, but also served as the first Patent and Trademark Office of the United States.
What's the message you're trying to send?
So the building, well, the background in supporting the concept of intellectual property protection really makes it ideal for discussing the economic impact of one of this country's most recognized IP-based industries.
Hmm. Dan Glickman is the CEO of the Motion Picture Association of America and on a major charm offensive in Washington. Dan, we wish you the best of luck and come back anytime.
I'll be glad to do it, and let's hope for a successful conference next week.
Amen.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dan. The MPAA is better known for its movie rating system than its role as the studio's man in Washington. Next week, we'll talk to MPAA President Dan Glickman about recently announced changes to the MPAA's rating process. No one is better at telling a story than the folks in Hollywood, but how successful will they be in telling their own story? We asked veteran Washington insider Nick Allard. He's co-director of the lobbying department of the venerable policy public relations firm Patton Boggs. Nick Allard, welcome to the business.
Glad to be here.
So this incredible charm offensive that's about to be unleashed upon Washington, is it a coincidence that 0.12 seconds after the Democrats take over that this boatload of Hollywood folk arrive?
It's not surprising, but maybe not in the ways that you might be thinking. Hollywood has had a better relationship over the last decade with Democrats than with Republicans generally. But more to the point, this is the beginning of a new Congress, and with the opportunity for there to be legislation. You know, the past Congress met for something like 21 days fewer than the so-called do-nothing Congress that Truman railed about in the 1940s, late 1940s.
Mm-hmm.
And now we've got a new Congress. There's a pledge to actually come to work during the week and not just show up Tuesday night, leave Thursday morning. And generally, the notion that here's a new opportunity to get some movement on legislation.
From the action being taken by Hollywood, do you think they fundamentally get Washington? And do you think Washington gets Hollywood? And if they don't, where do they misunderstand each other?
I think there is a degree of naivete that goes both ways. But certainly, the MPAA is one of the most sophisticated and has been historically one of the most formidable voices for its industry. The Directors Guild is similarly, you know, they've got very sophisticated, very talented staff. I mean, for years, Jack Valenti, who's now been replaced by Dan Glickman, was regarded as, you know, one of the very most effective spokesmen for his client. And so, you know, I wouldn't underestimate their ability to make progress on their issues and their agenda.
Who is going to come to these panels? Is this sort of the intern for a congressman or the congressman himself?
Well, any intern or staffer or maybe my wife who wants to be discovered and, appear in a movie. Staff may well attend and, others. It's not like it'll be a one-shot deal and then they'll succeed on all their issues, but it's quite an impressive, almost Herculean effort. It's not out of proportion with what often happens here in the entertainment capital of the world. For example, you know, once a month you'll pick up a newspaper and the Sovereign Republic of Fredonia, you know, will have a 15-page spread on the business and economic opportunities and human rights safeguards that
right.
Nation will have.
And the number one exporter of fermented horse urine or something like that.
There you go.
Yeah.
Another reason why this kind of activity makes sense is because with the new ethics and gifts and travel rules, it becomes much harder to bring lawmakers and staff to Hollywood to have this kind of fact-finding or information-gathering exercise or even trade associations. And it make
dispatching the Gulfstream 5, you know, David Geffen says, well, go pick up this Appropriations Committee and let's talk to them.
Well, they can pick them up under the new rules and under this proposed Senate rules, but the lawmakers have to pay for it.
Right.
So
let's talk a little bit about the venue for this gathering of eagles. It's at this museum, a brand-new museum, I should point out. It's the Nantucker McAvoy Auditorium at the Donald W. Reynolds Center for American Art and Portraiture. But it's interesting, to me at least on the surface, that Hollywood seems to want to do this in a, not in a slick hotel, but in a sort of erudite facility. We are not the breast-implanting, coke-sniffing, Ferrari-driving, latte-sipping people that were associated with the last culture war. We're classy. What do you make of the venue? Is there anything significant about that, or should we not read too much?
Yeah, it's close to Capitol Hill.
It is.
Yes.
Okay. Period. End of report.
It's a very appropriate setting, and it is in fact close to Capitol Hill. Getting across town these days is murder.
So, final predictions. Does this end in any catfights, or are we just going to have a major charm offensive and hopefully a slow evolutionary change here?
I think this will have a happy ending.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we'll leave it there. Nick Allard is co-chairman of the Public Policy and Lobbying Department at Patton Boggs in Washington, D.C. He joined us from their offices. Nick, thanks for being on the business.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Coming up after a short break, the writer speaks yet again. You're listening to The Business from NPR. This is The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. The Writers Guild Foundation and Tall Fellow Press have published a book called Doing It for Money, The Agony and Ecstasy of Writing and Surviving in Hollywood. It's filled with essays from successful writers about the business of writing for film and TV. In the sixth installment of our ongoing series we call The Writer Speaks, Winnie Holzman came down to our studio to talk to us. No relation to The Business producer Matt Holzman, Winnie was a writer on 30-something and created the TV drama My So-Called Life, for which she was nominated for an Emmy. She also wrote the book for the Broadway smash Wicked, for which she was nominated for a Tony Award.
A lot of times there's an encouragement within the culture kind of to look down on television writers as, I mean, I think this is true because I know when I wrote the show Wicked that's, you know, for theater, a lot of people, including other television writers, looked at me and sort of said to me, oh, so you're out of TV, right? You know, like now I'm at the big kids table and like I don't have to go back to TV, quote unquote. But, you know, I never saw it that way. I never looked upon it that way. I passionately love television. The only times I'm not doing it is because I can't get on the air. It's not like, and also I took a much needed break after Wicked. I was tired and needed to rest. But I mean, I love it. I don't think of it as settling or something I do to just make my living. Maybe other people, I mean, I know other people look upon it that way at times. I don't. And it's just always been true of me. And I've been very fortunate because I've worked with people in TV who felt the same way I did and also really cared about putting out something that would be just as good, we hoped, if it was a movie. You know, we never saw it as a step down or, you know, something to be ashamed of. Television writing is in such a strange, the whole business is in a real uproar and in a state of intense transformation. And not all to the good, I have to say, because of the corporatization that's taken place. But I do think that everybody who watches television is aware that there are some really incredible shows on television, and incredible writing on television. You just have to know where to look and how to find it. What I feel very strongly about is I really hope and pray that it doesn't get that good, strong, interesting, offbeat television writing doesn't become the home and province of just paid cable. I think it's very important that people who can't afford cable should be able to turn on their TV and find something really stimulating and interesting and sexy and viable, something that speaks to them. I don't know what I'd do if I wasn't a writer. First you cry, but that's what you do when you're a writer.
Here's Winnie Holzman reading her essay, Room with a View.
That conference room is too small, you say to Ed Zwick and Marshall Herskovitz after the very first table read of your very first script of your third television series with them. It's claustrophobic. Can't we have the table read somewhere else? Ed looks deeply into your eyes and says something eloquent that has nothing to do with your question. Marshall looks at you with the same expression he's looked at you with for the past 12 years, like he's happy you're there, but not completely sure who let you in. You drop the subject. But it's not just the conference room. The premise of this series seems, well, slight. Two good-looking divorced people meet and decide to date. Not exactly groundbreaking. You watch The Sopranos, your heart sinking. You've got concerns. You've got this musical you're supposed to be writing. You meet the director that Marshall and Ed just hired and take an instant dislike to him. It's mutual. You meet the actors. You have no idea what to say to them, and that's mutual, too. Actually, there's nothing to say to anyone because now you're in production where talk is worse than cheap. It's unshootable. There's nothing to do but write. Doing a series raises questions. Well, one question, really, over and over. Will there be enough? Enough time? Enough story? Enough approval? This is actually a trick question, and you know that, but for a while, you let it rule your life. Your mind becomes a too small conference room filled with actors you can't please, phone calls you can't return, conversations with your husband that you'll never, ever get to finish because you're locked in a very small room with a very small premise, writing. Once in a while, on the set, eating food you shouldn't be eating, or on the long drive home, it hits you. You have no idea who these characters are. You decide to pretend you do. You decide to make the characters confused. You give them your own confusion, which makes sense. Or you decide to pretend it does. You notice with amazement, even though it's happened to you many times before, that everything you decide to pretend about the characters instantly becomes who they are, like a magic spell. You love this. You decide to bring in more characters, to keep the characters you never understood in the first place company. The conference room gets even more crowded. The schizophrenic brother, the PJ Harvey fan, the visionary cappuccino repairman. You write an episode involving the main character's father, and when Paul Mazursky reads it out loud, your own, no longer living father is suddenly there with you in the crowded conference room. You're still on the air. The two divorced people aren't dating anymore. They aren't even two divorced people anymore. They're you, and Marshall, and Ed, and every other writer on the show. You want to tell Ed and Marshall how much all of this means to you, but you can't find the words and the meeting's almost over. There's nothing to do but finish the script, break another story, and realize the instant dislike between you and that director is actually a precious friendship. So you wander down to the set to find him, and actors take you aside and tell you things you didn't know you needed. Not only actors, wardrobe people, prop people, all people. Your every encounter becomes just what you needed. You use things your daughter says, things your therapist says. Wherever you go, there's the line you need. Ideas tap you on the shoulder at Starbucks and follow you home. You feel the end drawing near. Everyone does. You thank the craft service guy for all the delicious food and go upstairs for the last table read of the last episode of the series. You look around the room. The actors. The other writers. Marshall and Ed. You love them. You love them so much that there's absolutely nothing to say. You sit and listen as the last script is read, realizing you don't need more space or higher ratings or one more season. As it turns out, there was plenty of time. The room was just the right size.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
So Lord Jamal, speak, because we're giving you the business and putting on a show. You're $1 million man that ain't got no dough, but you got a hope. Tickets backstage to a show. Sedated, and at that fact they laid it. Time passing, your ass say, where's my loot? The reply is a kick in the ass from a leg in a boot. All you wanna do is taste the fruit, but in the back to make a fruit juice. You ask for slack and wanna get cut loose from the label. Not able, cause you sign at the table for a pretty cash advance. Now they got a song and dance that you didn't recoup. More soup with your meal, cause this is the real when you get a record deal. And I say, oh, shucks. Look what the cat hauled in. It's Fife Dog from a Tribe Called Quest. Let me begin like Chuck D. I got so much trouble on my mind about these no-talent artists getting signed. They can't rhyme. And if that ain't bad, you got bootleggers going out like suckers.
You've been listening to KCRW's The Business. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including The Treatment, a weekly conversation with some of the most influential and innovative people in movies and popular entertainment, hosted by film critic Elvis Mitchell. Check out the podcast of The Treatment at kcrw.com.